Okay, good morning everyone, and welcome to this last lecture of second week of banking course. There's not a big crowd of people here in the classroom at the moment, but hopefully next week there'll be lots more people because Denis Davidovich is coming all the way from Vaasa to give you the lectures. He wants to give those in person. I offered him the possibility to give those also online, but he very much preferred to come here to the classroom. So please try to come here next week in a bigger crowd so that Denis would be able to discuss with you. His lecture slides have been now downloaded to Moodle, so you can take a look at those beforehand and try to somehow formulate some questions to him already beforehand if you have anything regarding. He will be giving two lectures on digital banking. And I have also downloaded a new version of this first part of my lectures because I wanted to include some slides regarding these microeconomic things that we have been discussing here that should clarify you a bit more, these things. Okay, so yesterday we ended up in this slide and started the discussion about the role of capital adequacy and the bank, which means in safety for the part of owners, because if you want to maximize the capital amount, then you are basically investing into a safe bank, because there's lots of capital to be used for meeting the requirements of unexceptional risks, for example. But the other side of the coin is always the returns. So we found out yesterday that it's actually a trade-off between these two things. If you want to have higher returns, you are willing to sacrifice perhaps a bit of your capital. Or if you want to increase the safety of the bank in terms of increasing the capital adequacy, you are willing to sacrifice some of your returns. So these increases in capital should be a beneficial thing for the owners of the bank, by making their investment a safe target. And it's costly to the owners of a bank because the higher the bank capital is, the lower the return on equity. So we are thinking about this from the point of view of the owners. And this is the same thing regardless of the ownership structure of the bank, whether they are shareholders or whether they are stakeholder banks, the same applies here. Because obviously for the stakeholder banks, you are calculating also the amount of equity and other capital. The items in the balance sheet are exactly the same, regardless of the ownership form of the bank. And the choice depends very much on the state of the economy and levels of confidence. Obviously, in those circumstances, it might be the case that from the point of view of owners, it's more beneficial to increase the level of capital so that the safety of the investments gets to be increased. So it's very much related to the overall real economic activity. The better is the real economic activity, the better are banks doing, and the worse it is, the worse are banks usually do. So they have a positive correlation between each other. And the general levels of confidence are also very important here. They are also, consumer confidence indexes are strongly correlated with the real economic activity and hence also with the performance of the banks. But as a bank manager, you have to basically decide upon your preferences, that what are you trying to maximize? Are you trying to maximize the safety of the bank, which means the capital adequacy, or are you trying to maximize the returns? The other one goes ups when the other one goes down. So that is basically something that you have to be able to make a decision about as a bank manager. So here we have an application regarding these things. How did the capital crunch cause a credit crunch during the global financial crisis? So there's a causal relationship between these two things. two things. So when the capital crunch starts to sort of get to be launched in the banking sector, that refers to the capital crunch in the banking sector, it will have an effect on the willingness of banks to offer more loans to the general public. So around the 2007-2008 crisis, that started from the housing markets because banks were really heavily involved there. And they suffered great losses there based on their subprime investments. Also the European banks, even though the origins of the crisis was in the US markets, also the European biggest banks like Deutsche Bank, for example, had heavy investments in those markets. So they started to, the losses started to realize, and it led to the decreasing levels of capital, bank capital, because the profitabilities started to decrease. So shortfall of bank capital led to a slower credit growth. Banks were not willing to give loans. They started to be much more careful, so they could not raise much capital on a weak economy. That had a, because their own behavior had a role to do in weakening the overall real economic activity. They were not willing to give loans to customers. They had to tighten their lending standards and reduce lending. And the origins was basically in the housing market sector and financial inventions made there. So financial engineering things that were made there. So as a bank manager, you have to basically be able to focus on two forms of risk. The first one is the credit risk. And in broad terms, it just means the risk in your loan portfolio. How well are your loan customers that you are giving the credit to able to pay back their loans at each and every circumstances of the overall economy? And the other one is the interest rate risk that is related to the general development of the interest rates in the markets, because your profitability is basically dependent on the development of general rate of interests. You should understand this now based on our discussions regarding the term structure of interest rates and banks' idea of selling long assets in terms of their loans that they give to the general public and buying short liabilities. So the difference between the longer term and short term interest rates is of high relevance for the banks. And if the central bank wants to do something in terms of enhancing the profitability of banks, this is probably the first thing that it has in mind. Because it should be something that should have an effect on the profitability of banks. The first thing is the credit risk. So what are the possibilities for an individual bank manager to have an effect on his or her portfolio of risks regarding the loan portfolio that they are managing? First thing is the screening possibility. You are supposed to do some ex ante screening, which refers to the decision of giving a loan or not to the customer. So information production, it refers to information production to screen out the bad credit risks from the good ones. Obviously, a beneficial thing for you as a bank manager is to have a long-term customer relationship with the ones that you are giving the loans. So you have the data on those. How has been their payment development or had their payment activities, have they been able to pay the loans back previously? That has a huge role in your decision or willingness to give more loans. Then you might be able to specialize in lending. For example, you know the local markets well, so you are able to perhaps make excess kind of benefits in terms of knowing the local market better than the other possibilities of the banks or other banks outside your own area. You might be focusing on certain sectors, like, for example, agricultural sector, or small and medium-sized enterprises, or to big companies. The biggest banks are mainly perhaps interested in financing the biggest companies that are usually issuing common equity, shares of equity. So they are publicly quoted firms. And then interim and ex post monitoring and enforcement of restrictive covenants means that after you have made the decision that you will be giving the loan, you have a possibility to monitor behavior of your customers. Are they paying back the regular payments that have been agreed in the agreement? And are they meeting these restrictive covenants regarding, for example, the purposes of the funding that you have given them? They have originally been given the loan to purchase a house, but they are, for some reason or other, to make a decision after this decision of bank that they will be using the funds to other purposes. So that is something that's a violation against this restrictive covenant, basically. You cannot use the funding to other, you should not be using the funding to other forms of purchases, for example. So we are talking about these, in general terms, these theoretical ideas about adverse selection that takes place, that is a form of asymmetric information before the decision about funding has been made. And borrower moral hazard is the situation where the borrower engages into activities that are not allowed based on the agreement that was made during the decision of giving the funding. So these are the main forms of asymmetric information. The other one relates to the situation before you make the decision, the other one to the situation after. What kind of behavior does the customer actually engage into? So obviously, in terms of both of these, controlling both of these forms of asymmetric information, long-term customer relationships are of high use for you. So you may have economies of scale in the form of economies of scope, means that you are able to monitor closely, perhaps more closely, your long-term customers. So you take this into account. So you have big amounts of data about their previous behavior. And you have formulated kind of a risk profile for each of your customers. So you're able to basically, as a bank manager, you're able to decide upon the risk premium, the personal customer specific margin to the loan price or the interest rate that you're charging from the loan. So liquidity position of the customer, working conditions, work relationships, payment habits, etc., form of housing, for example, are important information for you. Then these loan commitments are a second thing. They promote the long-term relationship. And perhaps this is something that is perhaps a bit more characteristics for the stakeholder banks. They want to have long commitments for their customers. So it's easier to sort of ease in the burden of the information gathering based on those also. Then these collateral and compensation balances, collateral requirements help dealing with the adverse selection and moral hazard, both of these. So usually when you get the housing loan, your house is a collateral for that. And it can cover to be serving as a collateral for other forms of credit too, like your car loan, all these kind of things. Collateral is really important nowadays. And there are big differences actually nowadays between the banks, let's say stakeholder banks and shareholder banks. Stakeholder banks perhaps prefer more safety in terms of these real forms of collateral. And their requirements for the coverage ratio of the collateral value regarding the amount of given loan are perhaps a bit bigger in general terms, in average terms. They might require a bit bigger coverage
of the value of the collateral in terms of the overall size of the loan. Then compensating balance means that you have a minimum amount of account activities. You should be sort of an overall customer in that bank where you are going to be getting the loan. It also helps in information sharing, and it's actually one form of collateral, basically. So the bank is able to get all the returns from the payment activities also. It's a overall total customer relationship between the customer and the bank. Then credit rationing is obviously one possibility. So you're not willing to give credit or loan, even if the borrower would be willing to pay a higher interest rate. So basically, that is up to you. What is the risk profile of the customer? Are you willing to give loan at all? Usually, it results into a situation where the customer switches the bank. So in aggregate terms, it might be the case that it doesn't actually reduce the amount of adverse selection and moral hazard asymmetry in the overall banking sector, because banks are really competing against each other. Some banks might be willing to take a worse customer, loan customer, to their customer group, and in aggregate terms, it's not a good thing actually, because probably the same customer is not able to pay better to a separate bank or his loans. So that is actually, that's not a good thing. Usually banks use similar kinds of valuation models for the riskiness of the customers. So the same kind of risk profile should be priced at the same margin in each bank. But this competitive situation actually introduces this possibility that customers nowadays, especially when we experience this really, really low interest rates, the sort of a marginal willingness of customers to switch bank has increased quite a lot. So it might not result into a good situation after all. It may worsen the adverse selection and moral hazard. Then we go to a really, really simple models. Once again, we have to talk about probabilities. So bank solvency is something that you are actually interested about as a bank manager. And basically, the only thing as a bank manager to have an effect on the solvency level of the bank is to be able to monitor the customers, both the deposit customers, that's perhaps not so relevant, but even more relevant is the monitoring of the credit customers or the loan customers. So nevertheless, probability of banks' solvency can be denoted to be partly, at least partly, actually to a quite large degree, determined by this monitoring intensity. Intensity increases the more you are putting effort to the monitoring of the customers, either beforehand or afterwards, related to your decision about giving a loan. So cost of monitoring is denoted here by this general cost function. Only one argument there, the monitoring intensity. It has a positive first derivative. This discussion here is based on the Freixas and Rochet book, chapter 3, to be exact. For those of you that are interested about that, it's much more extensive discussion there. So take a look at that. But I have tried to develop a very simplified approach for you to be able to give you an understanding about the relevant things here. Monitoring is really relevant. And the monitoring is actually the cost function that is related to this behavior is convex. So basically, the first derivative is positive with respect to the monitoring intensity, and the second derivative is also positive. So we don't have this decreasing marginal cost of monitoring intensity. like we usually have in the production function. We have an increasing, so it's a convex. And as a bank manager, basically, theoretically, you should have this in mind that the more you do monitoring, the more difficult can it get in the future, because the customer relationships get to be more difficult and you have to pay attention to more information. The bigger is the customer portfolio, the more you have to do. So it's a huge cost actually nowadays for banks, and not the least from the pressures of the regulation. Regulatory authorities more or less force the banks to do monitoring nowadays. We have these bad experiences from the global financial crisis. The Finnish banking crisis was the first, actually, occasion in the Finnish history. But then global financial crisis was really bad. Now we have not experienced nothing like a banking crisis, because the liquidity in the banking sector was huge enough for them to be able to meet the corona crisis things. This was completely different crisis. So it's not a banking crisis basically at all. But nevertheless, monitoring has increased its importance, especially in the most recent 20 years of banking world data. So conditional on the bank being solvent, income generated by its loan portfolio is denoted to be RL. So the more there is riskiness at the aggregate or average level of your customer portfolio for loans, the higher is probably the required rate of return that you want to have from that portfolio. And banks' repayment for borrowed funds. So this is referring to all forms of borrowed funds at the moment. So for example, interbank funding is also here included to this general measure of deposits, basically because you can, that should be comparable, that, or that should be a substitute for deposit funding. So interbank funding, basically the price of the interbank funding can be at the pretty much the same level. They are substitutes. Just in terms of the maturity needs for the bank, you may get to be involved more in interbank funding compared to deposit funding and vice versa. Nevertheless, so this is a joint cost item for those both. So once again, we have this profit function. Now it's really easy. It's a linear function, basically. We normalize for the sake of simplification. We normalize that the size of loan portfolio is exactly equal to all the funding that you get. So basically, the interbank funding is now included to this deposit portfolio or amount of deposits in the bank's balance sheet. So here's the profits function. And this note here, actually, that I added here, is necessary for you to understand these derivatives, because from the previous version of these slides, I forgot to put this, because this is actually relevant to be able to take the derivatives of the relevant factors at all. It's not actually given in the Freixas and Rochet book chapter at that point, but you cannot basically get the result unless as you assume the functional form for this cost of funding. So let's assume here that, first of all, the profit function looks like this. So the monitoring intensity is the relevant thing here. You are probably taking derivatives with respect to that. But it's a function of loan, or the arguments regarding that are the loan rate and the funding rate, the deposit rate. And then there's a fixed cost of monitoring also. So assume that also that the bank's amount of repayment for each unit of funds and the net proceeds from issuing loans are both inversely related. So basically, the more you do monitoring, the less you are able to pay for deposits or other funding, and the less you are able to get net proceeds from your loan portfolio, actually, because it's a cost item for both. It's not different. We are not assuming that it's different for monitoring the deposit customers compared to the monitoring the loan customers. It's the same here. You have to put effort on both of these, because, for example, the amount of deposits might be really relevant information variable in your decision to give the loan. How much has the customer been able to save previously? What's the amount of deposits? So we are interested about the optimal amount of monitoring. How much should we do monitoring? So the profit maximizing choice of monitoring intensity can be calculated based on this partial derivative of the profit function. And once again, first order condition gives you an idea of the optimal level of these things. So if we take a partial derivative of that profit function with respect to the monitoring intensity and set that to zero, we obviously get this very simple first order condition. Marginal intensity or marginal change in the willingness to monitor more, monitor intensity by the banking sector or bank manager is dependent on the difference between the returns you get and the sort of efforts or costs that you have to pay, RL minus RD. Because we are referring here to the unitary change, it's one unit change, so it's a marginal change in the monitoring intensity. And these are also one unit percentage values for one unit of loans and one unit of funding or deposits. So the first order condition will be looking like this. We have to remember that the monitoring intensity is actually in relation to the RL and RD. We assume that both RL and RD are inversely related to the monitoring monitoring intensity. So both are basically 1 over n. The more you do monitoring, the less you are able to pay for the deposits, and the less you are able to get returns from your loan portfolio in net terms. In Freixas and Rochet's book, actually, this has not been discussed very clearly, but the simplifying idea behind this model is the one. I wanted to clarify this for you. So if competition on the lending side increases, RL goes down. It's not possible to charge so high loan rate or loan interest rate as an individual banker if the competition increases, because the customers might change the bank. This is the thing that I already discussed. So in general or average terms, loans are cheaper at the aggregate level to the firms or other customers. If competition on the deposit side increases, it refers to the situation where the funding ratio, the funding cost goes up. So you have to pay higher interest rates to keep the deposit customers in your bank. Okay. So basically the competitive situation in the banking sector is really important thing here in terms of the monitoring, optimal amount of monitoring also, because it has an effect on RL and RD that are the relevant factors in your decision on how much to monitor. So basically, now that we remember what kind of relationships we did have for the RL and RD with respect to the M, both of them were inversely related. So in simplest representation, RD is equal to 1 over M and RL is equal to 1 over M. So based on that representation, we can now get the partial effects of changes in the loan rate. How are they affecting to the changes in the monitoring intensity at the optimal level? So based on that, so you have to remember here that what we did in terms of the assumptions for this. So we assume this one here. So this is the functional form for RD, that is function of M, and RL also that is function of M. And here's the first order condition. So basically, when we start to derivate the model for the M or the cost function, then we get the result for the optimal amount of all, for optimal responses of the monitoring intensity with respect to the loan rate and also with respect to the funding rate. So basically, we see from here that it's a positive thing, the effect is positive, So the monitoring intensity is increasing when the loan rate is increasing, and the monitoring intensity, optimal monitoring intensity, is decreasing when the deposit rate is decreasing. Optimal monitoring intensity is increasing when the deposit rate is decreasing. So competition in general terms, competition can be referred to either lowering RL values or increasing RD values. Either one of these can happen. And they usually happen simultaneously. Banks compete against each other in terms of loan rates, loan interest rates, and deposit or funding rates. So competition in general increases riskiness of banks, the need to do more monitoring. That's the main result from here. So basically, competition might be something that the authorities perhaps should actually try to prohibit to a degree. And usually we think in the economics literature that competition is always good. But that this result actually says that not necessarily in all circumstances it is good for the aggregate sort of a riskiness of the banking sector. Because the general message from this analysis is that competition increases riskiness of banks, increases the need to do more monitoring, actually. So that is actually quite an interesting thing, because this is different from the general ideas of market equilibriums or market free markets in the economics literature. So this is actually a fairly interesting thing. Yeah.
I'm thinking one of the other option would be to limit the size of banks and how in that way control the risk.
Yeah, exactly.
Regulation, though there might be some banks that would carry the risk. But if we save the customer size and we have some kind of saves for the average customer, they don't lose all their
But basically, this is related to the Jari Mikko will be discussing about these things. What is the role of biggest banks and what is the role of smaller banks? Biggest banks should have the same standards in terms of supervision. So basically, their size also should be something that should be limited. And for example, in the European markets, European banking markets, so ECB area, ECB is actually the one that regulates the biggest banks. For example, in Finland, Nordea and OP Group are the ones that are being supervised by the ECB directly. And ECB is very worried about the size of the individual banks. It wants to enhance competition, but it actually has this mind also that it actually increases the riskiness of banks if the competitive situation is too high. So in the Finnish banking sector, for the part of biggest banks, we don't actually have this because we have only these two really big banks. Domestic authorities, the Finnish supervisory agency, actually FIVA, is controlling or supervising the smaller banks completely. And the number of banks has actually decreased quite a lot recently. So basically that has reduced in terms of this thing, actually, it has also reduced kind of to a degree the riskiness of the banking sector, because the number of banks has decreased. It's easier to monitor the smaller number of banks. But the main thing here is that basically I have argued quite a lot about this, that it should be not be exactly the same kind of toolbox that you are using in terms of supervision for the biggest banks compared to the smallest banks. Because the biggest banks are always international players. Smallest banks are not. So basically, if you sort of use the same hammer to hit all the banks with the same force, then it's not fair, perhaps, to the smallest banks, because their information set is completely different. They know the local customers very well. So the individual customer risk is pretty much smaller. compared to the large banks that usually have also investments in foreign portfolios, so they basically don't know the foreign customers very, very well. So this is actually, this is related also to this competitive situation in the markets. And Jari Mikko will be discussing about these things in terms of actual supervision of the banks. But you are right in that, that it might be actually beneficial to reduce or restrict the number of banks. But it has not been the case actually in the recent development of the banking sector, because from natural reasons, from cost efficiency reasons, the number of banks has been decreasing all the time. Actually, Dennis will be also discussing about these things in comparison between the standard banking sector and digibanking. So he will be discussing also about this next week. Yeah, but you are right there. So the second thing as a bank manager for you is to be able to manage the interest rate risk. And there you have some tools, readily available tools, like for example, duration analysis. But that is something that you just have to sort of be able to apply to both sides of your balance sheet, to the asset side and liabilities side. So you have to be able to detect the items in both sides that are rate sensitive and those that are not rate sensitive. So fixed, you have a set of fixed rate assets and you have a set of rate sensitive assets. And here are some examples about those. And you have both, you have those on both sides, but you may have those at different amounts. So basically the riskiness regarding the sensitive, rate sensitive assets in this case, for example, is really different compared to the liabilities side, because you have a huge, you have a higher amount of liabilities. Basically similar kind of assets and liabilities, but different amounts. So you have to be always able to determine the exact amount, at least at the end of your fiscal year, that are being denoted to be rate sensitive with variable interest rates or variable rates and fixed rates. So that is the thing that you have to be able to do here. So suppose the interest rates with these numbers, based on these example numbers, suppose interest rates rise by 5 percentage points. This is really big. Nothing like this has happened for many years in the European markets and will probably have not happening in many years. But nevertheless, this is once again an extreme example. So for the part of income related to your asset side, the amount that changes that is related to the amount of rate sensitive assets. So 5% times $20 million gives you an interest income that goes up by $1 million. And on the other side, the liability side, the same thing happens there. The same kind of items are there. So you get an increase in the interest expenses by 2.5. So this gives you an idea about the sensitivity of these items, because you have a clearly bigger amount of liabilities there. The cost related to that, to the interest rate risk in general, interest rates, market interest rates is actually quite big. So the difference between these guys is 1.15 million. So if more or less rate sensitive liabilities than assets in your balance sheet increases or decreases in the market interest rates, reduce your profits. So it's not a good thing for you. You have quite a big interest rate risk in terms of your rate sensitive items in your balance sheet. So usually you have these kind of tools to be used, like gap and duration analysis. Basic gap analysis in a banking case refers to the difference between the rate sensitive assets and rate sensitive liabilities times the change in the interest rates, gives you an idea about the change in your bank profits. And obviously this is really important for you in terms of having an effect on your bank capital. So your capital adequacy gets to be reacting to this because it has an effect on your profits. Profits are the thing that if you get positive profits, they increase your bank capital. If you get negative profits, they decrease your bankrupt capital. So in terms of capital adequacy, this is really important thing. And there are lots of refinements basically possible here. First refinement would be that you are not just taking these aggregate values, you are willing to focus in much more details in different maturities. So then we are discussing about maturity bucket approach. So you, the measure amount of rate sensitive and non-sensitive assets and liabilities at each and every maturity. So basically that difference that was there, 30 million, can be dependent only on one maturity. If you sort of a clean that effect away, then you might get a completely different result in terms of your interest rate, overall interest rate risk. Then the second possibility is to use so-called standardized gap analysis. So that accounts for different degrees of rate sensitivity. So there might be different sort of a reference rates for each maturity. So this goes even to much more detailed analysis. So there are lots of things that you can do. The main thing here for you as a bank manager is to understand that what is the maturity profile and what is the connection of each items in your asset side and liability side to the development of market interest rates. At which maturity you have the reference rates for each and every item. Usually in bigger banks, so the small branch managers get this information readily from the headquarters. Sophisticated guys like you in the future will be calculating those values and you get the reports for your interest rate risk. So they can also get suggestions on what to do, how to hedge against these, what kind of maturity, at which maturities you are required to use some tools like interest rate swaps. Is it useful for you to change from sensitive, rate sensitive positions to not sensitive, to fixed rate positions, or what you should do? Okay. So there's this general definition of duration. We are not paying too much attention for this in terms of the actual calculation, but there are, for example, Macaulay durations that give you an idea about the sensitivity of the market value of the bank's total assets and liabilities to changes in interest rates. But nevertheless, you have to be able to figure out the actual maturity profile on both sides and then calculate based on the reference rates that you have for those items, calculate this, perhaps this duration. So it refers in general terms to the percentage change in market value of the security that is defined as minus percentage point change in interest rate times the duration in years. So this uses the weighted average of duration of funds and securities assets and its liabilities to see how the net worth is dependent on the changes in the interest rates. So this is something that you have readily available tools. For example, you can calculate if you have the data on your balance sheet, very detailed data for assets and liabilities and the maturities that are relevant there, then you can calculate, for example, in Excel quite easily these durations. One of the tools that is available, for example, in Excel is the Macaulay duration calculation, for example. So the other thing, up until now, we have discussed only about balance sheet items because the balance sheet is the main profit-making tool for each and every bank originally. But then we have this possibility of doing also off-balance sheet activities. So basically, we can participate on the loan sales. So we can remove the loan from our balance sheet, sell it, bundle it up, or bundle the loans up, and then sell those to other banks. And for example, in the OP group, it has been possible to sell housing loans to the central cooperative. So we are bundling up a good quality housing loans and sell those to the central cooperative and get kind of a payment for that. They get to be sort of a wiped out from your balance sheet, but you have been able to get some
returns from that. And then there is also this generation of other than balance sheet related income items, fee income, for example, servicing the mortgage-backed securities or any other securities, and guaranteeing debt, backup lines of credit. So these are examples of other income items that you can get when you are doing banking activities. And trading activities are really important for, perhaps more important for shareholder banks. So the banks that are in the really active in the wholesale banking markets, not so much perhaps for the cooperative or savings banks or other more like institutions connected to the traditional banking services. So these trading activities to be active in the financial markets are important. For example, for Nordea in the Finnish case, much more important than, for example, the OP Group. OP Group takes part to the general funds markets in terms of getting funding for its member banks from the international financial markets. But Nordea is much more involved in trading with other financial institutions' assets, actually. So they trade with financial futures and options for debt instruments, interest rate swaps. OP is also obviously also interested about in terms of the hedging point of view of interest rate risks. They get to be involved also with swap markets, for example, quite a lot. But for example, transactions in the foreign exchange market are for the OP Group in a minor role. They basically carry all the currency risks at the overall group level of the whole group. Individual banks are not sort of carrying any currency risk in their any activities. They are not involved. The operations related to the international customers are really in a minor role in standard cooperative banks in Finland. Then we have this principal agent problem. In this case, actually, it might be the case that traders may want to take excessive risks. So obviously, the more you are involved into the global financial markets, the more you are also sort of exposed to the global international risks. So in terms of supervision, it's absolutely necessary, actually, to supervise these kind of activities quite closely, because they are the origins of the, for example, global financial crisis in 2007-2008. So it might be a case that we have these kind of a principal agent problem in this case. So there might be possibilities to try to control this principal agent problem by, for example, separating the trading activities and bookkeeping. Bookkeepers should be absolutely the ones that are interested about obeying the law and requirements and restrictions on trading, not the traders, perhaps. Traders are only interested about getting profit. Bookkeepers should be more kind of a, not perhaps sophisticated, but more lawful guys. They are interested in following the instructions and the law. There might be, or there should be, and there are limits on the exposures to different items in the financial markets. So you cannot, for example, invest too much to the stock market related assets compared to the interest lending assets. And in usually banks are using various kinds of risk measurement procedures, risk measurement models, especially related to these items. So for example, value at risk, that you will be paying close attention in Juhani's course on derivatives, for example. Value at risk calculations are the things that you usually use to calculate the riskiness, overall riskiness of your portfolio. Stress testing is the thing that refers to the situation that if something unexpected happens in the markets, for example, in terms of the interest rate risk, what is the result or what is the effect on the bank's assets and the bank capital and bank's liabilities? And the international regulators or institutions are doing these stress testings for the. And the most recent results, for example, regarding the Italian banking sector from the ECB test for the stress tests have been a bit alarming. There are some individual banks that are really exposed, for example, to interest rate risk. Interest rates are really low at the moment. So if we get a 1 percentage point increase in the interest rates, there are some banks in Italy that might go bankrupt immediately after that. So these stress testing are actually really important. Then let's move on to the discussion about kind of an industrial organization profile of the banking sector. Let's discuss about the role of structure and competition. And this is actually quite nice sort of a pathway to the next week's lectures that Dennis will be giving to you, because he will be also discussing about this competitive situation in the banking sector now that we have these digibanks, digital forms of banking. So in many countries, we have the case that banking sector is quite concentrated, actually. For example, in Europe, so a relatively small number of banks, big banks, are dominating the individual country-level banking sector. So there are these oligopolistic features. You don't have very much players. Nothing like a full competition or completely competitive situation. And obviously, it's quite hard to measure the degree of competition. We can use these kind of Herfindahl or other kinds of indexes to calculate actually the competitive situation within certain market segments in certain countries, for example. But it's usually fairly difficult to calculate because the characteristics of the banks are so different and the customer or the clientele profiles are so different. So it's really difficult to compare, for example, an individual OP bank in Finland to another bank in some other region, because the customer profiles, for example, are really different. There are some really big banks globally, and these are the things that are really worrying in global terms. If they start to perform badly, like, for example, the Deutsche Bank in global financial crisis, it has a huge effect on the area-wise or regional, in big regions, the regional effects. Like, for example, for the European banking sector around GFC. So in the US, there are some unique features. So for example, the US market is perhaps more competitive. It's clearly less concentrated, but the number of banks has decreased also in the US market quite a lot. As an example, we have these number of banks in, for example, 2019. This refers to the numbers in 2019, actually. There were dominating banks in Nordic countries. The total number of banks was 400, and the dominating ones were in Denmark, the Danske Bank, Jyske Bank, and Sydbank, and in Sweden, Nordea, until 2018, after which it moved its headquarters to Finland. And Skandinaviska Enskilda Bank and Swedbank and Handelsbanken are the biggest bank ones nowadays in Sweden. In Norway, we have this National Bank, and in Finland, the OP Group. And nowadays, the bigger part or the bigger guy here is Nordea, because it's a Scandinavian or it's a Nordic bank. So it's clearly bigger in terms of balance sheet. By the way, I have downloaded already at least a week ago the annual reports of both the OP Group and Nordea to the Moodle site, and you can take a look at those, because out of curiosity, you find that nowadays bank groups actually report really different things in their finance reports. For example, the OP Group is very much focusing on sustainability things. Almost half of the annual report covers its attitude towards sustainable bank. Nordea is much more interested in reporting the actual factors or facts and numbers there. So it's not very easy actually to find out the relative, for example, the amount of bank capital in the whole OP group from the annual report of the OP group, because they are focusing on these supposedly really important things in the near future. they're focusing on the sustainability of the banking sector. What kind of role would the OP Group have in enhancing green transition in Finland in general? Nordea is perhaps more interested about raw numbers and the profitability of the Nordea Group, but nevertheless, it's also very interested about the sustainability things. So if you want to really, if you want to focus, for example, in your thesis works to the sustainability things, then go first and take a look at the OP Finanssa Group's latest report, and then come to me and we can start the developing of the other literature, the article-based academic literature related to these things. This is an emerging subject in many ways, because the banking sector is going to be playing a big part actually in this green transition towards a carbon neutral global economy. It will have a huge role. The question is that what is going to be the role of digital banking sector? Is it actually taking some sort of sidesteps, or for example, if it's too much based on cryptocurrency kinds of activities or blockchain things, what is the role of energy consumption there? Is it able to enhance sustainability things based on these things? So take a look at those. They are really interesting to read. You should be able to get some numbers there that we have been discussing here in terms of the standard banking theory or banking ideas, but they are clearly different. You can get an idea there that the Nordea is much, much bigger. It's over three times bigger than the OP Group in overall terms. And it should be because it's a multi-country bank. Here is a list of biggest banks in the world from this year. So you see there actually one kind of perhaps alarming information, because China plays actually a huge role in terms of the banking sector nowadays. The first five biggest banks are from China. That's only natural when you take into account the size of the country in overall terms, the size of population in the country, for example. But it is something that probably the banks in China are a bit more governed by the public sector or the government in general. So, and Japanese bank, or the four biggest banks are from China, and the fifth one is from Japan, and only at the sixth place is now JP Morgan, that comes from the US. So these are the most recent numbers regarding these things. European banks are fairly small compared to the biggest Chinese banks. For example, the biggest European bank is this UK bank, Bank of Scotland, and then here is the Bank of America, that is actually has been the seventh biggest in previous numbers, but it has lost its sort of a position there. And then there's this first Crédit Agricole Group, France, that is more like focused on agricultural firms funding and agricultural sector funding. So basically, you can see from here that the European banking sector in global comparison is perhaps not so big at all. So if we are starting to experience these new global crises, if they come from the banking sector development or banking sector investments, they might come clearly from the China nowadays. In 2010, 2008, around the global financial crisis, the US markets, so the US banking sector played clearly higher role. Now the situation has changed. So the Chinese market is really important in these terms. So there have been lots of bank consolidation in the US sector. US banks, a number of banks has declined dramatically over the last 30 years. And there have been lots of failures and mergers and acquisitions. And for example, this Deregulation Act actually from 1994 had a role to play there. So basically it has eliminated most restrictions on interstate bank acquisitions, and bank holding companies were allowed to acquire also banks anywhere in the US. So the development has been there a bit different than in China. So what is the role or what is the meaning of these having these bigger banks? Obviously, they can have these economies of scale in terms of information gathering and make the most of the information technology because they have the resources. Basically, in Finland, it should be actually the case that the OP Group is leading these, using these advances in information technologies in the banking sector. And actually, it is the one that is also able to enhance the sustainable banking activities based on this, if they are based on future steps in using the most advanced information technology. So it requires always huge resources, and economies of scale is always useful. And the US trend has been in this case towards smaller banks changing or going through mergers and acquisitions to be a part of bigger banks and bank groups. So the number of commercial banks in the US has really decreased tremendously, also during the latest years. So this is the figure from until 2020. So these are the latest figures that we can get from the Federal Reserve of St. Louis database. So it has been decreased really a lot. And one of the reasons is the importance or rising importance of also the digibanking sector. And Dennis will be discussing about these things next week. So one question that is really relevant is that what will, for example, be the structure of the US banking sector in the near future? So what is the end result now that we are experiencing also this forwardation of the digital banking system? It will be having an effect also on the US economy and also in the European level. The general message is that the number of standard banks will be decreasing. And there have been lots of discussion about these new forms of finance. We have been discussing also about these crowdfunding forms. In general terms, they refer to these decentralized finance platforms. So if they start to be rising, their role starts to be increasing in the US economy, it will be also decreasing the number of standard banks. But nevertheless, their main idea should be perhaps nevertheless based on this very standard idea of bundling up bigger amounts of sources for funding, perhaps in the form of some kind of deposits or something like that, and then issuing loans to the customers in need for funding. Basically, they are still serving the same function in terms of channeling the financing needs between the excess sectors to the ones in deficit. Okay, so there's an academic debate actually going on regarding this role of decentralized finance forms. And Campbell R. Harvey has actually written a very nice short book about this called DeFi, D-E-F-I. It's not a very expensive book. If you want to buy that from Amazon, I recommend that one because he's focusing really, he's having a forward-looking sort of a attitude towards the emergence or role of normal standard banking sector in the very near future when we have these possibilities for decentralized forms of banking. He's a bit skeptic about the need for the standard banking sector at all. But nevertheless, everything is very much related to the role of central banks in the future. How are they? What is their attitude towards these various forms of decentralized finance in the future? Because nowadays, all the monetary policy actions are being channeled to the real economy through the standard banking sector. They have no counterparties in these various forms of decentralized finance still. So if we once again still go to these models, once again, we have a really, really simple form of model here. If we take a very short look at the basics of competition in the banking sector once again, because this is related to the situation or decreasing number of banks. Competition is decreasing, or obviously when the number of banks is decreasing. So it might be a really relevant thing also in the near future. So we can use the standard industrial organization, the IO refers to the industrial organization approach to banking competition. And we can use that kind of a benchmark, and we are ignoring special aspects of banking. And let's try to use some clarifying notions about competitive pricing and market power. So once again, let's write down the profit function. So the main thing that the banks try to do is to give loans. They get their loan rate for their loan portfolio, and they have to pay also for the banking market involvement, so interbank markets. They might, if they have an excess supply of funds to the interbank markets, then it's a positive thing here. So M here refers to the net positions on the interbank market. And basically, it is equal to the 1 minus alpha, where alpha refers to the required reserves on deposits, minus L. And then we have these cost item that is nowadays not very much different from zero, because the banks are not obliged to pay basically any deposit interest rates on their deposits. But let's hope that we will be getting to a bit normal situation somewhere in the future. So in that case, this RD would be at least marginally different from zeros, and then it would be a cost item. And then we have this general cost function that is related basically also to the monitoring. So we have to monitor the customers that are related to the deposits and the customers that are related to the loans. How well are the customers able to pay their loans back? Bank once again maximizes its profits by choosing the optimal amount of D and L and taking prices, the interest rates as given from the markets. So here we replace now the interbank market position with this 1 minus alpha times D minus L, and collect these similar items together to get a representation for the profit function that looks like this. This is standard algebra, nothing difficult here. Actually, I had an error here than the previous version of these slides, because you know, I think that I had R, but it should be alpha, obviously, if we replace this to the definition of M in that equation. So this is the sum of so-called intermediation margins, sum of everything in terms of the prices of the things that the bank is doing in terms of its activities. Intermediation means that it is getting the deposits and issuing the loans. It has assets and it has liabilities. So this is in net of management costs. So the C here refers to all the management costs related to the deposits and loans. Once again, we take differences. We take partial differences of this general profit function in terms of the optimal amount of loans. For example, we try to find what is the effect of changes in the loans on the optimal amount of profit. Once again, these are the first order conditions, standard economics maximization, optimization problem. And then for the second item, we get the partial derivative of profit function with respect to the amount of deposits. Once again, this is from the Freixat and Rochet book. I don't remember exactly the chapter number, but it's a bit different than there, because he uses various modifications in terms of the role of, for example, monitoring costs and so on. So I just use a, let's say, more simplified version to get you an idea about the relevant things that have an effect on the profits of banks. So if you take the derivative of the profit function with respect to the deposits, you get this. Set that to zero. So a competitive bank chooses D and L optimally so that the intermediary margin of loans and deposits are equal to the respective marginal management costs. So you have a management cost from managing the loans portfolio, and you have the management cost from managing the deposits in your banks. So we are now separating these two things because they might be a bit different. Obviously, it's much more essential for you as a bank manager to be able to monitor the loan portfolio because that's the source for your returns. Deposit portfolio is something that sort of lives its own life there that is highly dependent on the rate of interest rates in general terms. But this is something that you perhaps have more power to have an effect on that loan portfolio. So if the interest rate on deposits increases, and that comes for the most part from the changes in the market interest rates, the bank's demand for deposits decrease. And if the interest rate on loans increases, the bank supply of loans increases. As a reference rate in the loans interest rate, you have the market interest rate. So the market risk or market interest rate risk is there too. But it's in your own decision, actually, to decide the side or the size of the interest rate or the level of the interest rate on the loans. So that is perhaps a more important, but it's in this perspective, it's important to deviate these two things actually, because you have more power on doing decisions regarding those. What is the interesting thing is that what are the cross effects actually? So we get here the results for the effects of interest rates on deposits and on loans. What are the effects on your optimal amount of profit? But what are the cross effects? If the loan rate increases, what happens to the deposits? Or if the deposit rate increases, what happens to the loans? For that, you have to get the cross derivatives, partial cross derivatives. So you have to take the second derivatives. You are first taking a derivative with respect to the D, and then the derivative with respect to the L regarding the cost function. And so you have here a case where it can be zero, so there are no cross effects. If it's below zero, then you have economies of scope of monitoring those deposits also in terms of having affected through the loans also. And in the other case, when this is higher than zero, then you have these economies of scope. It might not be useful for you to monitor at all the deposits. So if you have this first case here, if you have a negative second derivative, then thanks to economies of scope, deposits amount of deposits increases when the loan amount or the loan interest rate increases. If you have, so basically, a universal bank that jointly offers deposits and loans more efficiently than two specialized items. And you actually can get these by using second derivatives and the Cramer's rule to get these effects. We won't go into those details, but take a look at, once again, that book by that microeconomics banking book that I'm referring here to the Frakes and Rogers book to get these results. So basically, this highlights the role of all the dependencies between deposits and loans. But the most important thing for you to understand from here is that perhaps actually the monitoring of loan portfolio, at least currently, is the relevant thing because the deposit rate is so low at the moment. It's practically zero. So marginal changes in the close to zero level deposit rates probably don't have any effect on the loan demand at the moment. So that's the main thing. Okay, then a very short look to the role of financial innovations. We have already been discussing about those things also very shortly here. So the main thing here to understand is that these financial innovations are obviously always driven by the desire of the banks to get more profits from various forms of things or new forms of activity And these are usually outside the balance sheet items. So usually it has been something that has been in connection to the changes in the operating of funds and environment, because the funds markets have developed quite a lot. There are lots of institutions that are focusing nowadays only on trading activities in the funds markets, like, for example, money market funds and so on. So the banking sector has more or less been forced to also participate to these activities and develop also some products of their own. So in addition to the deregulatory effects, the financial innovations have increased the competition, for example, in the US and European banking sectors because of these emergence of new forms of financial institutions, actually. And as a background for that, we have these changes in the advancements in the information technology and management techniques and derivatives introduction. Derivatives markets are nowadays basically the most liquid and active markets compared to the spot markets of, for example, commodities and these kind of financialized products. Okay, so it has also increased the competition in the US and European markets, and actually it has decreased the number of standard banks in both these markets. So you can use, actually, if you want to take a closer look at the role of this financial information, you can start that from a fairly old article, taking a look at this fairly old article by Frame and White in Journal of Economic Literature. That is one of the key, most important journals, actually, in economics literature, Journal of Economic Literature by the American Economic Association. And in that paper, they find that, or they state that, in general terms, you can define the financial innovations activities that reduce banks' costs and risks, or allow them to better meet the needs of customers. That's a really broad definition for all forms of financial innovations related to costs and risks and ability to meet the new needs of customers. There are lots of financial innovations, new products, new production processes, and new organizational forms of the banks and other participants in the funds markets. So it's something that obviously is also related to one kind of financial innovations are the digibanks. And Dennis will be discussing about this next week. So take a look at his slides in terms of these ideas also. And there are these examples about the effects of financial innovation on the demand side. You can take a look at these. We don't have to go through these because you obviously actually are familiar with most of these things. We can basically, the main idea here in the classification, that you can actually classify these developments in financial engineering and financial innovations to the demand side and to the supply side things. And we have been discussing about basically everything here in terms of the demand and supply analysis. So in economics terms, you should be able to always try to frame out somehow these concepts that are related, for example, to the development of the financial markets or financial engineering products, financial innovations, to the ones that are related to the changes in the demand side and to the changes in the supply side. Supply of funds and demand of funds is always the relevant thing. So we don't have to probably go these through in too much details, but perhaps this one is most interesting in terms of the for the part of the supply side things, because this is really related to the increasing degree of speculative behavior also in all the sectors of financial markets. So this securitization has played a really big role, for example, in the development of the subprime mortgage market crisis, and also in the development of, for example, various sectors in the commodity markets. Because nowadays, basically for each and every commodity, in addition to the
demand and supply-based spot prices for current behavior, you can actually hedge or speculate against the spot prices, the equilibrium price, in the futures markets. And this is actually part of the securitization that we have seen. So for example, for almost every kind of commodities that are nowadays starting to play also a big role in the banks, market activities, for the biggest banks, they are active players nowadays also in the commodity markets. And the big question is that what might be the reason for a, let's say, Nordea bank to buy oil futures if they are not oil producers or they are not heavy demanders of oil products? Nevertheless, the big banks do have a role to play also in the futures markets for this. And the main reason for that is just to get excess profits from the differences in the prices or returns in the futures markets and spot prices or returns. So the basis, the difference between the futures markets and spot markets valuation or returns gives them a profit. And short selling is one of the key things that these big financial firms actually are heavily engaged in there. This is something that will for sure be focused by the regulators and central banks in the very near future, because the role of commodity markets has been increased, especially in this green finance or this green transition phase, the renewable energy related commodity markets, like for example, precious metals and so on, they start to be having a clearly different role in the near future. And speculation is really bad there. If the speculation in the future markets introduces, based on the securitization of these commodity markets, if the speculation in the future markets also causes changes in the spot market prices, then it's really bad for the producers of the renewable energy production or any components related to that. Now, the banks and the financial sector might have a really big role in terms of this. So this is not a minor thing, this securitization or financialization of the commodity markets at all. So another thing here is this regulation that, so basically the regulation is going to be having a big role also in terms of this development of these financialization and securitization of various forms of the asset markets in the near future. So basically, here are final slides about the competitive discussions or competition discussions, what kind of trade-off do you have between the increasing the level of competition and the stability of the banking sector, exactly the thing that you actually raised up here. So basically, you can take a look at these slides. There's nothing in terms of theoretical ideas. There are some definitions that just need to be understood here. So basically, you can take a look at these. These are by yourself. And you just have to understand that the banks are kind of special in this respect, because they try to optimize the amount of net worth. And they try to make use of information asymmetries in that regards. So they are able to gather lots of information about the customers, and they should be able to use that information, get the excess returns from that. And then there's role also for the market structure in this respect. So it may be profitable for a bank to supply more loans, but and its lending is likely to be sensitive to shocks into its balance sheet. So basically, this is referring to the sort of a financial accelerator literature that actually starts to be losing its significance nowadays, because this information asymmetry things are a thing that is changing all the time, because regulators have a focus on here, they have a big role here in decreasing these information asymmetries. So banks have to behave in a certain way. And moreover, the availability of information has increased quite a lot, actually. So nowadays, basically, the European level, you should be able to take a look at also the
previous payment behavior of other banks as a bank manager also when you make a decision whether you want to have a give a loan to the customer or not. So take a look at these slides, and we won't go through them actually in more details. There's a discussion about the trade-off between stability and productive efficiency and these things. So there are some references also to the old literature. I don't pay too much attention to these things because next week Dennis is going to be introducing you to the most recent developments, also in terms of this competitive situation in the banking sector, now that we have these digibanks available. So here are some references for further reading for those of you that are interested perhaps in these micro-based approaches in banking sector or banking profitability, for example. Here's also one paper that I have written with colleagues of mine about the effects of negative interest rates on the performance of the Finnish cooperative banking sector, the OP Group, once again. And it is actually now available already from this journal, International Review of Financial Analysis. You can take a look at that. We do a very detailed analysis at the size group level of Finnish OP banks, reference groups, R1 referring to the biggest banks, R2 referring to the medium-sized banks, and R2 referring to the smallest banks. What is the effect of negative interest rates on their profitability? When you measure that with various measures, return on assets, return on equity, net interest margin. So what has been the effect? And the results are a bit surprising. The effect has not actually been so negative as we would have sort of expected. So I'm doing also research using another method, panel econometric methods. In that case, we are only using time series econometric methods. But if any one of you is interested about this profitability discussions with respect to the effects of negative interest rates, you can come to me and we can have a discussion about whether it would be something that you could be focusing in your thesis, for example. There are also some other references. This one is really interesting paper. Altavilla and others have focused on credit supply and demand in unconventional times. So it's forthcoming in Journal of Money, Credit and Banking. They have a really specified microeconomic level data set about the amounts of credit that the customers have been demanding and the amounts of credit that the banks have been supplying. So it's really based on their results. It's really important sort of detect the factors that have an effect on the supply and demand separately before you join those into an equilibrium relationship in the loan markets. So take a look at that's also available from the and Karlo Altavilla is actually perhaps the most active guy nowadays doing these negative interest rate and zero lower bound analysis regarding the banking behavior and banking activities. Some of these papers will be given to you as the material for the home assignment one, but not all of them. In addition to these, because you will be having three possible themes that you can choose from. The list of references is not full here. So for example, Dennis will be giving me next week some ideas for the papers that he would like you to take a look at. If you want to do home assignment on for example, these digital banking and perhaps currency, perhaps cryptocurrency markets. Okay, so thanks for joining me for this first part of lectures. And on Monday, I will be downloading the second part of the lectures to the Moodle, and Dennis's lectures are already there. So take a look at the slides beforehand and be prepared to discuss with him and raise questions regarding the themes that he will be discussing next week. So see you all next Wednesday. And today's quiz will be covering all the rest of the material in the first set of slides that was not covered last week's quiz set. Okay, thanks. Have a nice weekend.
Thank you.